Last time I was up here, I made a horrible rookie mistake. I know better. I know after all my years of teaching various things that you got to be careful of what you say from the pulpit. But somehow I missed it. Near the end of my sermon, I said that I hadn't gotten to everything I wanted to talk about. and that sometime we should do something on the dietary laws. Now, when you communicate to people, you got to realize what they're hearing and what you're hearing are not necessarily the same thing. And I knew the moment I said it, Wendell's over there thinking, ah, I filled in that last slot in October when I'm going to be gone. But it was too late to exit out. So here I am. That's about the voice with which I would have responded to Wendell. Well, hopefully the series that we've been doing in the Pentateuch has helped reacquaint us with some of the things that we forgot about, or for some of you, maybe acquaint you for the first time with it. As I mentioned before, we just don't spend a lot of time meditating on obscure Old Testament passages, and among the list of things we avoid are often sections of the Pentateuch. We like stories. We're not so much good on law. We also tend, even in our own studies, to pull small segments of Scripture out that provide us with comfort or maybe some sense direction. But to spend time looking at the place of the law, you know, it seems so foreign to our modern sensibilities. And we suffer from what C.S. Lewis has called chronological snobbery. This old stuff can't possibly be relevant to us. The Bible certainly talks throughout its breadth of the number of times and ways that God is building a royal priesthood in Israel. It calls Israel his treasured nation. The Old King James translates the phrase, a peculiar people. But when we look at the laws of the Pentateuch, we certainly think they were to be a peculiar people, but not perhaps in the sense that was intended as a special people, but we think of it as weird, strange. And so we have a more pejorative sense of that. And we do see a lot of this as strange stuff. In good sections, sometimes we think it's a little quaint and old-fashioned, but other times we often think of it as just bizarre or demanding or cruel, and above all, irrelevant. After all, we're not under the law, but under grace. So why do we need to bother with this? And especially the dietary laws fits into that category. Clearly in the New Testament, these are abrogated for the believer. They're no longer in force. But that doesn't mean we need to discard them. There's still lessons to be learned. Remember, all scriptures God breathed and useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness. And Romans 15:4 says, everything that was written in the past was written to teach us. So, we've got to ask, what have you been taught in your personal study of the Pentateuch? You know, how much have we been taught by it? Or have we just not bothered at all because it fits into all those categories I just mentioned? But clearly there are lessons even here to be learned, but the question is, what are they? And today we're talking about these dietary laws, and the primary text is Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14, which is sort of summarizes what's in Leviticus 11. And part of the problem of dealing with something like the dietary laws is just reading one of those passages. It takes up about half the sermon time. But we're going to do it anyway. So I suggest if you have a scripture or a phone with a Bible on it, pull up Leviticus 11 and follow along, because you're going to hear my words as monotonous after the first two sentences probably. And I do want you to pay attention to the content here. Eleven, starting in verse 1. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Say to the Israelites, of all the animals that live on land, these are the ones you may eat. You may eat any animal that has a divided hoof and that chews the cud." You're inspired yet? "There are some that only chew the cud or have a divided hoof, but you may not eat them. The camel, though it chews the cud, does not have a divided hoof. It is ceremonially unclean for you. The hyrax, though chews the cud, but does not have a divided hoof, it is unclean for you. The rabbit, though it chews the cud, does not have a divided hoof, it is unclean for you. The pig, though it has a divided hoof, does not chew the cud, it is unclean for you. You must not eat their meat nor touch their carcasses, they are unclean to you." And we're down to verse 9. "Of all the creatures living in the water of the sea and the streams, you may eat any that have fins and scales. But all the creatures in the seas or streams that do not have fins and scales, whether among all the swarming things or among the other things living in the water, you are to regard as unclean. And since you are to regard them as unclean, you must not eat their meat. You must regard their carcasses as unclean. Anything living in the water that does not have fins and scales is to be regarded as unclean by you. These are the birds you are to regard as unclean and not eat, because they are unclean. The eagle, the vulture, the black vulture, the red kite, any kind of black kite, any kind of raven, the horned owl, the screech owl, the gull, any kind of hawk, the little owl, the cormorant, the great owl, the white owl, the desert owl, the osprey, the stork, any kind of heron, the hoopoe, and the bat." Got that down? "All flying insects that walk on all fours are to be regarded as unclean by you. There are, however, some flying insects that walk on all fours that you may eat, those that have joined legs for hopping on the ground. Of these you may eat any kind of locust, katydid, cricket, or grasshopper. But all other flying insects that have four legs you are to regard as unclean. You will make yourselves unclean by these. Whoever touches the carcass will be unclean till evening. Whoever picks up one of their carcasses must wash their clothes, and they will be unclean till evening. Every animal that does not have a divided hoof or that does not chew the cud is unclean to you. Whoever touches the carcass of any of them will be unclean. Of all the animals that walk on all fours, those that walk on their paws are unclean for you. Whoever touches their carcass will be unclean till evening. Anyone who picks up their carcasses must wash their clothes, and they will be unclean until evening. These animals are unclean for you. Of animals that move along the ground, these are unclean for you. The weasel, the rat, any kind of great lizard, the gecko, the monitor lizard, the wall lizard, the skink, and the chameleon. Of all those that move along the ground, these are unclean for you. Whoever touches them when they are dead will be unclean till evening. When one of them dies and falls on something, that article, whatever it is, will be unclean, whether it is made of wood, cloth, hide, or sackcloth. Put it in water, and it will be unclean till evening, and then it will be clean. If one of them falls into a clay pot, anything in it will be unclean, and you must break the pot. Any food you're allowed to eat that has come in contact with water from any such pot is unclean. And any liquid that is drunk from such a pot is unclean. Anything that one of their carcasses falls on becomes unclean. An oven or cooking pot must be broken up. They are unclean, and you are to regard them as unclean. A spring, however, or a cistern for collecting water remains clean, but anyone who touches one of these carcasses is unclean. If a carcass falls on any seeds that are to be planted, they remain clean. But if water has been put on a seed and a carcass falls in it, it's unclean to you. If an animal that you are allowed to eat dies, anyone who touches its carcass will be unclean till evening. If anyone eats some of its carcass, must wash their clothes, and they will be unclean till evening. Anyone who picks up the carcass must wash their clothes, and they will be unclean till evening. Every creature that moves along the ground is to be regarded as unclean. It is not to be eaten. You are not to eat any creature that moves along the ground, whether it moves on its belly or walks on all fours or on many feet. It is unclean. Do not defile yourself by any of these creatures. Do not make yourselves unclean by means of them or be made unclean by them. I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves and be holy because I am holy. Do not make yourselves unclean by any creature that moves along the ground. I am the Lord who brought you out of Egypt to be your God. Therefore, be holy because I am holy. These are the regulations concerning animals, birds, every living thing that moves about in the water, and every creature that moves along the ground. You must distinguish between the unclean and the clean, between living creatures that may be eaten and those that may not be eaten. Wow. Certain repetition to the formula, but there are distinctions in there that you may not see as you read along. But certainly it's quite exhaustive and it draws a clear line between what's clean and unclean. And we need to keep a number of terms sort of clear in our minds. Clean is not the same thing as righteous or holy or unsinful. Unclean is not the same thing as sinful or evil. We're dealing here with things that are ceremonially clean or societally clean and not necessarily with sin and its destruction. That doesn't mean there isn't a connection. Obviously, cleanliness is a type of being righteous, and uncleanliness is a type of being unrighteous, but they're not making a direct comparison. These are only analogies. So some of the understanding this passage centers around understanding the context in which it's put in. As you know by now, as members of this church, everything has various contexts. Here we have to see this in terms of what he's attempting to do here. He's taken Israel, because of his promise to Abraham, out of Egypt. He's made a covenant with him to be their God, to watch over them, they to worship him and obey him. And now you have this group of people that have come out of a totally foreign culture. Remember, there is no nation of Israel formally before this. They're not being taught a catechism on the things of God. They're living in Egypt. There's some things they know about God from reminiscences back to the patriarchs. But there's no complete system. They've been living in a pagan society. They don't know how to live. They don't have any laws because the laws were the laws of Egypt. So God's in a position of bringing them into a number of things, bringing them into a nation that functions as a nation and protects individuals within that nation. So it's not a matter of a power grab by anybody. So he lays down righteous principles of governing for the nation of Israel as his chosen people. He's establishing their worship system because, again, they've been exposed to who knows what prior to this. There is no formal system for worshiping Yahweh at this point. He's establishing it as a way of encouraging righteousness on their part, encouraging their commitment, but also as a light to the rest of the world, to draw people in to the true God. So all of this stuff has to be established in a short period of time. We also know that this first part here of Leviticus is dealing with the establishment of the worship in the tabernacle, the functions of the priesthood, the various activities of the priesthood, how they're to dress, how they're to act. And it's within that context that this section actually appears. Prior to this, in 1 through 8, there are instructions to the priest on it. It's actually some narrative in there that deals with a disaster that happens when two of them are struck dead. And at that particular point, something interesting happens. You have everywhere in the Pentateuch, it talks about God speaks to Moses and says. At that particular point in chapter 10, it's God speaks to Aaron and he says. Why Aaron? Well, Aaron's the fatherhood of the priesthood. I mean, That's his particular purview. So these instructions are given in context of that sort of setting. This deals with how the priests are to distinguish clean from unclean. An important verse or a section of that chapter 10 is 10:8-10. So chapter 10, verse 8 through 10. Then the Lord said to Aaron, "You and your sons are not to drink wine or other fermented drink whenever you go into the tent of meeting, or you will die. This is a lasting ordinance for the generations to come, so that you can distinguish between the holy and the common, between the clean and the unclean, and so you can teach," verse 11, "and so you can teach the Israelites all the decrees the Lord has given them through Moses." And this same type of statement of learning to distinguish between clean and unclean and holy and common appears at the end of the chapters 13, dealing with another topic of that applies cleanliness and uncleanliness, and at the end of 14 and at the end of 15. So this is a repetition here throughout. This is important. These are to teach you how to distinguish between the clean and the unclean. And that then leads up after the section on dietary laws and the other sections dealing with a number of other areas of life that have to be regarded this way. You then get to the Day of Atonement in 16. So all of this is a progress leading up to it. He's preparing them here in the distinguishing between clean and unclean to be worthy of entering the tabernacle for the Day of Atonement. In chapter 11 through 6:34, he again spells out the distinguishing principles between clean and unclean as they relate to different areas of life. So let's go back to this chapter 11 with the understanding both of its context here in the section of the book, but also in terms of the terms clean and unclean. We're not talking about animals here he's listing that are somehow evil animals. God created every animal good. So that's not the relationship here. This is dealing with cleanliness as it's related to God's select people here in this setting in Israel. So it divides in this chapter 11 animals by category. And these are the same sort of three categories you see in Genesis 1. So you have the land animals or land creatures, water creatures, and flying creatures. And these correspond to those same descriptions from Genesis 1. So some of the examples we talked about, land animals, the principle is if they chew cud, and they have split hooves. It can't be one or the other, they have to have both. And by the way, chewing cud here is not the same thing we think about in terms of a cow that chews its cud, well, basically eats food and doesn't chew much of it, swallows it, later regurgitates it, chews again, swallows it. It's not necessarily that. You do have some animals mentioned here that don't do that. But what seems to be here is the category that fits into animals that chew over a period of time. So therefore, they nibble and chew that real good and thoroughly before they swallow it. Or those who traditionally chew the cud. So all those are fit into this category. We can see from the examples that are there. Then in the area of water creatures, it has to have fins and it has to have scales. It can't have one, not the other. It has to have them both. Flying insects, which are part of the air, occupiers of the air, they may be eaten, but hopping, or may not be eaten, but hopping, sorry, missed my spot in the note here. Flying insects may not be eaten, but hopping can. And then, there's a lot of other distinctions as we looked through there. There's a distinction made between creatures sometimes and animals. So we've got to, when we read through it, we don't just sort of assume that creatures means animals in general. It's dealing with a specific category. So over the centuries, probably since the day God set these out, there's been a lot of discussion over what these mean. What's the rationale for all of these choices that God makes? You know, why does it, what holds us all together? What makes sense of all this so it's not just random? The rabbis themselves, when you look at rabbinic writings, they spend a lot of time looking for symbolic explanations. Aristeas said that chewing cud makes animals clean because it reminds men to meditate on the law. A for creativity, F for being helpful. Another writer believes sheep are clean animals because it reminds us the Lord is our shepherd, and dirty pigs represent the filth of iniquity. Well, okay, that's clear. There are literally dozens of different types of explanations, rationale for these food laws. But most of them, when you look at them and divide them out, they fall into one, probably four different categories. You know, thinking in general terms, they fit into four different categories. The first one are those who believe that it's arbitrary. God's setting up test of obedience here. So he's just saying, this is the way it is. Follow this along as a way of getting them to obey him. That he needs to be obeyed, and this is a test to see if they're going to do it. So it's no particular reason that ties these all together. It's just a straight test of obedience. And apparently a significant number of ancient rabbis, including the great 12th century rabbi Maimonides, held to this. He takes it in that, that's the expression that's involved here. The second category is that of ritual purity. These are here because the forbidden things are things that reflect either false gods in some of the religions around in Canaan, or they're animals that are used in sacrifice for pagan religions. And that has some appeal to it, you know. But historically, it falls short. I mean, one of the major false gods in that region, Baal, was represented by a steer, a bull. And of course, that would not fit with cattle being able to be eaten. In addition, pigs, although they were eaten in other ancient Near Eastern countries around Israel and their religions, they were not used for sacrifice. They were abhorrent in sacrifice. So that doesn't seem to fit the pattern either. So there are problems with this, as there are problems with all of these. The third one is hygiene. And many modern people like this, we're always looking for the latest fad diet, and so there's got to be clues in here how to eat. We have the Daniel diet, we have the diet based on a passage in Exodus, we have, there's even a food bar out that takes a passage from the law that has seven or eight ingredients listed and put them all in one bar to say, this is the perfect thing, God says so right here. Well, he doesn't, he just explains what product is there in the land. But anyway, I digress. We grab onto this because as modern people, we're interested in health reasons with food. And, it seems obvious pigs, have a lot of problems with trichinosis, and therefore he's preventing them from eating these horrible animals that might disease them. It brings all sorts of questions to mind. I mean, certainly it's not a reason given in Scripture. But if that's the problem, then why doesn't he just tell them to cook them thoroughly before they eat it? Or why no restriction on plants that are poisonous? Don't eat this because it's poisonous. Now, the trichinosis thing is a bit overblown. It was a big problem primarily because of more modern farming traditions. The free-range pigs that they would have had out in Israel at that time ate much healthier, and trichinosis probably was not even a problem, according to medical experts I've read. But the big one is, why does Jesus then in one fell swoop saying, it's okay to eat these? Suddenly it becomes I mean, if that's the reason trichinosis is still around today, then we got problems, I suppose. And the fourth category of interpretation, the attempt to find a unifying factor, is that they illustrate other things. And of course, we know that that's true to some extent, because even the concept of clean and unclean is a symbolic thing. But this suggests that the examples provide a picture of something else. Sort of think of Aristeas in his chewing the cud, representing the need to meditate on the law, that sort of thing. The great intertestament Jewish teacher Philo said that clean animals represent the virtues of discrimination, because the are in chewing of cud is the meditation, and the cleave of the hoof is discernment. Okay, I mean, it's not a bad allegory, but I don't know if it's what's intended here. And again, the problem with symbolic things is if you have no sort of boundaries to what you can substitute in and out to represent something, then you can pretty much say anything. You just have to find things to say. But another category that's in this line is, and there's a whole line of people that held this as well, is they believe that a lot of these selections have to do with blood and death. And so, for example, the birds of prey are generally eliminated because they would be eating already dead things, and therefore the blood that they have would be contaminated by the blood of something dead, which, of course, you're not allowed to touch carcasses before you go into the temple. There's some interesting observation there, but again, I don't think that necessarily is the sort of universal principle that's going to tie it all in. Most interesting is one that came from 1960s or 70s, somewhere in there, a socioanthropologist by the name of Mary Douglas. I think she's a Jewish gal. She spent some time studying the laws in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, and suggests that what God is doing here is defining ideals that fit each category. And then when things deviate from that category, then they're no longer fulfilling the role with which they're supposedly created. Just like when we sin, we pull ourselves out of the created order that God presented to us. And as she points out to other delineation laws, for example, in the law, don't mix crops in the same field, don't combine two materials into one garment, don't intermarry with the pagan cultures around you. And in her mind, these dietary laws are, each category of creature has its own sphere of motivation, and each creature in that, in order to be clean, has to fit that qualification. There's a lot to be commended on this. I don't know if when you actually look at every detail that they all fit in that category. But this is certainly an approach that has been pretty popular in the last 50 years or so. And a lot of Jewish scholars, traditional Jewish scholars, as well as a lot of Christian scholars, have picked up on this and think that this might have a good explanatory purpose for the passage. But I think all of them have some insight, but none of them fit all the criteria to be a complete solution. You know, we often have ideas in life that we think is a solution to something, and then we have the problem of making a universal solution to everything. And that is where we get into difficulty. But we clearly have instructions from the New Testament that reveals we no longer need to keep these laws on food as Christians, but what lessons can we garner then from the passage? And I don't know as there are one or two. I think there's a lot, and I think we need to spend some time examining it and saying, Lord, what's in here for us? What do we need to take away from this? And I'm sure there's a lot of those. But in today's modern Western evangelical experience, I'm taken by a couple of lessons which I think we desperately need to be reminded about in our world today. And the first one is, in the Old Testament law, and even in these dietary laws, we see that every detail of life is under God's banner. We forget that. You know, we think of, we have our religious time, our spiritual time, and then we have the rest of life where we go out and act like everybody else. And we fail to see that every area of life is to come under the lordship of Christ. Do all things to the glory of God. Everything is ultimately His. And we're used to compartmentalizing, you know, religion's something we do, you know, for an hour and a half on Sunday mornings, and when we, you know, scratch our eyebrows, it's at lunch or supper time when we're eating out and say a brief prayer and two words. But is that it? You know, how much do we live life consciously aware of the lordship of Christ at that moment in time? How much does our interaction with other people center around knowledge that they're created in the image of God and therefore aren't better or worse than you? We're on the same playing field. We're all sinners that are in need of redemption. And therefore, I need to treat people with respect because they are created in the image of God. And if I have respect for God, I have to have respect for His image. That doesn't mean we have to run around, you know, with halos over our head, pietistically, you know, acting like, but we do have to realize and consciously think about, why am I doing things? Why do you do it this way? What do I think about this? And the first thing is not our gut level response to it. It's where does it stand under God? The law is great at reminding us of that if we just read it. He's trying to bring together a people that are going to be His royal priests. And He wants them to be aware that every detail is His. And the world should see that there's a difference between them. Which flows us into the second point I think it's important to emphasize in our setting today. We are to live, act, and believe as people of God. We're to be separate from the culture around us. We don't take in entertainment the way other people take in entertainment. We don't approach our meals with the same way. You know, John Warwick Montgomery used to say, every meal on earth is a rehearsal celebration for the wedding feast of the Lamb. We have totally capitulated to the culture around us. And indeed, for most Christians, the important thing is, how can I be normal without standing out too much? I think we ought to stand out too much. Not in a weird way, but in a way sanctified by God. Just as the law demonstrated to other people Israel's selection as the people of God, as an attempt to draw the nations to the true God, we are in a similar boat. The New Testament describes the church as a royal priesthood. It commands us to bring others to God. And the thing we often don't think about, the Greek word for servant is primarily not servant, it's slave. Slavery is a highly motivated term. Therefore, we avoid using it in most places in life. But our call as Christians is to be slaves of God. And again, that's something that takes up your whole life. It's not something that's just a few moments here, a few moments there, and the rest of the life we live, think, act, breathe like the pagan around us. Because we want to blend in with the pagan around us. The reason for these separation laws is not to blend in with the pagans around us. And that's our calling as Christians as well. Something to consider.
Thanks, Denny, for the work that went into that. And really appreciate that. I think there's plenty for all of us to think about there, and hopefully that serves as a motivation for additional study for us as well. I think particularly for us, the two consequences or applications for us that Denny drew out are very relevant. We've said this a lot here. I know you've all heard it, but I'll repeat it again. This sort of idea we have that we can distinguish between spiritual and unspiritual, or sacred and secular aspects of our lives, is not found anywhere in the Bible. If it comes from anywhere, as far as we can tell. It's most nearly Greek philosophy, and that's not something around which we should be ordering our lives necessarily. So I think there's plenty of room for reflection there for us. But I'm going to close us this morning with a couple of verses from 1 Peter 2. Peter writes, speaking, of course, to the church in the New Testament, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." You're dismissed.